This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The first few weeks of 2017 were a tumultuous time. President Trump's inaugural address set the tone for what was to come, and meanwhile, parts of the news media did the same. 1A debuted. The BBC also launched a show hosted by Caddy Kay, and the New York Times went live with a daily podcast called The Daily. Back in November, after the midterms, we all met in front of a live audience at the Lincoln Theater in Washington. It was a very special night for us, and today we'll share parts of that conversation with you. First up, we spoke to the host of The Daily, Michael Barbaro, and we started where so many shows start, the theme song.
Theme music is this incredible art that I think that the people who listen to podcasts don't appreciate the amount of work that goes into.
Well, what went into the Daily's theme?
The Daily's theme music was a torture session of these two guys in Portland, Oregon, who have made a lot of audio for the executive producer of the Daily, and they would get on these conference calls with us. It was just endless tweaking. What about this? What about that? What about this? And I had the brilliant idea, not at all, that the original Daily theme music should sound like Westworld, because I had been watching Westworld. And this kind of like melancholy string music. And they very generously built it into the eventual Daily theme music, but it's an exercise in patience and indulgence and ultimately, you know, rejection of bad instincts.
So, Michael.
So, Joshua.
How was your day?
How was my day?
I hear it was a little busy.
It was a little busy. We were supposed to be here. This is a classic Daily thing where people say to us, you need to be at a place by 5, and we have such good intentions to be there by 5, and then making the Daily means we will be there at 6:30. What happened today was a classic day in the life of the Daily. We had wonderful plans for tomorrow's Daily to be a gorgeous 20-minute documentary about China, and we were gearing up, the machine was revving, and then Michael Cohen, and that's the story of the Daily. I mean, people often ask, you know, how come one day the Daily sounds like, you know, Frontline, and the next day it sounds like Michael Schmidt in a studio processing the news, and it's because of Donald Trump. It's because there's really no telling what the Daily, and I guess all news, but especially a Daily show that started in February 1st, would be without the kind of news flood of this presidency.
Now, you had been doing a podcast in the last months of the campaign called The Run-Up.
Yeah.
Was that helpful in terms of shaping the Daily?
Absolutely. I have no business hosting a podcast.
Why do you say that?
Because I have no background in audio, and I feel like a complete fraud half the time. And the woman hired to create audio at the Times went searching for a host, and she watched YouTube clips of some people whose names you know well, Nick Confessori, one of my good friends, and many others. And just like she believed there was something in my voice and demeanor, which I still don't understand, so she let me audition for the show, and we did the Run-Up, and that turned into the Daily.
We got a question from a listener about your delivery. Ryan tweeted, how did Michael end up with that incredible cadence in his voice? We have a clip of you, and I'm just gonna ask our engineer, Jake Cherry. Let's hear it for our engineer, by the way, Jake, who does not get enough credit for being the mastermind behind the show. Jake, if you would play clip one for me. Here is a clip from the very early days, kind of working out the tracking, the on-mic pre-recording of the Daily.
It's Wednesday, February 1st. What am I getting wrong?
It's hard to explain.
It's Wednesday, February 1st.
The music is like clang.
Sounds good to me.
It's Wednesday, February 1st. And then it starts.
I know, these directions are not meaning a whole lot to me. It's Wednesday, February 1st. I don't understand it.
Can we just do all of these Wednesdays?
Let's go. It's almost 1 a.m.
Yeah.
It's Wednesday, February 1st.
There you go. That's a wrap.
I mean, what you're hearing there is somebody trying to wrap their head around the idea that one intonation of that was better than the other, because I just had no experience in audio. Can I answer your question about
Yeah, yes, how'd you figure
it
out?
So it comes from the following fact. I was counseled, out of all the normal things people say to fill time, such as, you know, like, by a cruel, I believe, grandfather, Alan Rosenberg, who told me that I couldn't say them. I mean, this is actually the story of linguistic child abuse by a Jewish grandfather who said,
do you want to move to that couch? Because that might be a more comfortable place for this confessional
said,
that's coming.
This is what he would do. He would say, you know, when people say, I just did it, you know. He would say, no, I don't know. That kind of thing. Anyway, it was counseled out of me, so I don't fill space. So unfilled space is unfilled space when I talk. And it's producers who will come out here later can tell you that sometimes I leave so much space in between the words that they have to cut it. But the benefit for audio producers, if you know anything about audio, is sometimes you need to move things around. The way I talk is very helpful to audio editing.
It's easy to edit.
Yeah, it's easy to edit.
Well, even that cadence, I mean, I hear you in terms of trying to figure out what your sound is. I'll go back and listen to something, and this has been the case through my entire broadcasting career. I've been in public radio about 15 years, almost 15 years now, and I could, at any point in my career, listen to what I had done the year before.
Mm-hmm. You sound different.
And been like, how the hell did they hire that guy? It changes every single
year.
Well,
can I just tell me something that the producers say to me that they've clearly never said to you? I mean, you have such an extraordinary energy. Like, you are so here, and you're so present, and you... And the most stinging feedback I get from producers is that I'm, and this is, sounds like a Donald Trump insult, but that I'm low energy. And that I need to kind of pick it up a little bit, like higher energy.
Okay, listen, I got two words for you.
Yeah.
In terms of being right for radio and having the right
sure.
sound for it. Ira Glass, case closed.
Yeah.
Nobody, even him telling his own story, like he knew that he had this, who would have picked his Ira Glass?
Who?
From WBC Chicago, This American Life. Eklund. Nobody! But you're the guy in the chair, and you're the one who has had to figure this out, including figuring out how to produce the daily. The mm-hmm. nice thing about podcasts, I think, is that they can be produced in all kinds of spaces. I understand that the setup at the Times, they set it up in like a closet, like an unused
yeah.
room. What was that about?
Well, when we first started the Daily, we were assigned a giant utility closet on the 16th floor of the building. And very interestingly, this was a room that had been devoted to the computers that needed to not be connected to the internet to receive the first big batch of leaked documents that The Guardian and The New York Times and that consortium got. That they didn't want anyone to trace the source of. So we were in an old utility closet, and we put all the special matting on the wall to silence it. But we were an exciting afterthought when we started. I mean, no one knew we were gonna. It sounds like with you, no one knows when you create something new if it's gonna work. And so people pat you on the back and they wish you good luck, and we see what happens.
One of the things that both of our programs try to do is have these kind of national conversations that
right.
don't turn into cable news style kind of shouting matches. Sometimes on our program, which is live, that doesn't always go to plan. If Jake would play clip two for me, there was a rather spirited conversation we had on 1A one time, a
mm-hmm.
clip we'd like to share about civility. It included Christine Fair, who's an associate professor at Georgetown, along with three other guests just talking about the nature of civility, and I kind of it required me to be the well, listen.
There have been countless psychological studies on the profile of the Trump voter and why they're so respondent to fear, right?
Let's be careful about not painting people with too broad a brush.
No,
some of those folks are in our audience
talking,
and want to empathize
and,
with
and,
what
and,
you
and,
have to
and,
say.
And,
no,
talking
no
talking
really, hold
studies.
On, everybody stop. Everybody stop. Stop. Because, see, this is where civility starts. It starts and ends with me. I'm in charge of this conversation, so everybody stop. Let's be careful about painting anyone with a broad brush. I totally understand the anger that you bring to this. I hear your frustration. Do not categorize people that broadly. I don't think it helps.
Thank you,
and I think a lot of those folks are in our audience. And
sir,
I'm trying to be an advocate. I'm trying to hear you.
Sir,
but I'm trying to make sure we advocate for everybody in our audience. So just, you're skirting up to a line, Christine. I just need you to pull back a little. Do you hear me?
Did this air?
This was live. At that moment, it was like, okay, Jesus, take the wheel. Nothing I can do. And listen, but here's the thing. Like, people tweeted after the show, like, go ahead, Christine. I said the same damn thing. Not that one of them is sitting over in the box with my family who looks exactly like my mother, but there were people who totally felt where Christine was going from. Like, I wonder how it's been for you. I mean, this
we
moment...
would never have more than two people on at a time.
No, I get that. But
I can't possibly fathom how to handle that many people.
But in terms of the tone of the conversation you have with the nation at a time,
yeah,
when many Americans legitimately just need someone to listen to them scream.
Yeah, I mean, the Daily is born out of a moment of chaos, right? I mean, the election was so ugly, it was so partisan, it was so angry, and people were emotionally bruised, and I think they were intellectually kind of like trying to wrap their head around something that was happening. I think the show benefited from the fact that those of us making it, including me, who had been a print reporter, a national political correspondent, who felt a little exposed about my own lack of understanding of the election, we knew that what we were up to was a conversation that rolled everything back and was honest about what we didn't understand, and we were going to be curious along with the listeners and not going to give them conclusions and not going to be dogmatic and not going to be judgmental. And that was the guiding philosophy of the show. Let's be non-judgmental, let's be curious, let's be nuanced, and let's see where this all goes. And that was the exact opposite of the moment. They did, in a way, we're giving ourselves too much credit. The moment was so brutal that I think the world just needed something not as brutal.
That's Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily from the New York Times. You're listening to highlights of an event last year held at the Lincoln Theater with 1A and The Daily. We'll hear more from Michael and introduce a few more special guests in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. If you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
The world is complicated, and for many of us, history class was a long time ago.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's new history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline, history like you've never heard it before.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Let's pick up our conversation from an event last year at Washington's Lincoln Theater. The evening was called 1A and the Daily. It was a moment to mark what an amazing 2 years it has been for our show and for the podcast from the New York Times. As lots of you have noted, folks in the daily news business have been kept very, very busy.
One question that a member of the 1A audience asked for you is, Michael, do you sleep?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I really do, because we make The Daily the day before, and it's a dirty secret. It took us a long time to admit it, because we loved when people wrote in and said, you must be up till 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning. And we sort of let that go for a year. We let people think that. But the reality is that we make the show the day before, and we have some really late nights, especially the producers, who are the best producers in the business, and they work their ass off, and they are up sometimes very, very late hours. But the latest I've ever been up was an unfortunate Donald Trump news conference in Asia when I had to get up at 4. That's the latest I've ever been up.
Is it going well so far? Are you having fun?
I'm having a ton of fun. The best part about making The Daily is getting to know my colleagues in the New York Times newsroom who I never would have spent time with. And I now have license, and we all do at The Daily, to rove across this newsroom of 1,300 people and say, I want to speak to our reporter in Beijing. And they will say yes. And we will spend 2 hours with them chewing over a really complicated story and exploring with them, where does the story start? What's the middle? What's the climax? What's the big idea? How do we land something that feels beautiful and emotional and revelatory? And it's like a first-class ticket to the world that we get to do from the studio.
More than we want to ask you about the program, and we'll get to some of your questions as well, we should move on to our next guest. But for now, let's hear it one more time from Michael Barbaro, everybody.
Thank you, guys.
Sit tight right there. Michael, if I could ask you to make room on the couch.
To the real psychological couch, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Joining Michael and me on stage are two of his colleagues from the New York Times. One of them is the man who ended up being one of the very first guests on The Daily. He's also been a fantastic guest on 1A. We're also pleased to be joined by an assistant editor for The Times. Please welcome New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak and assistant editor Michaela Bouchard.
Hello. Hello. Thank y'all for making time for us.
Hey, this looks great.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm on like the Tonight Show or something.
No, right? Which is exactly why I'm nervous. I'm like, oh my God, the bar's too high. But we are glad that you are here. This is more fun than the Tonight Show.
And did you pick these green couches?
Yeah. Say again?
Did you pick the green couches?
I did not pick the green. Why, you got a problem with it?
Oh no, I've always walked. I've had like a lifelong fantasy of having us.
It's a pretty comfy couch.
Yeah, green couch.
There's a picture of you online on a yellow couch, as I recall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does anybody know? I'm gonna look for that yellow couch picture. Yeah.
Put that up there.
Yes. We will work on that immediately. Adam, while I'm looking for that, Adam, yes. Lipsack, let me start with you. I'm interested in hearing kind of what your repertorial lives have been like, the three of you, in the last few years. Let me take you, Adam, back to July 9th, the day that the president was going to announce his latest pick for the Supreme Court. For The Daily, you and Michael ran through some of the most likely candidates, and you started with Brett Kavanaugh. Did you have a sense then that that was going to be the pick, or of how it went, or kind of, can you kind of take us back to where your head was at the time and the way you talked about it then?
I think Michael said, I'm not going to force you to make a prediction, but if you had to pick, who would it be? And luckily, I said Brett Kavanaugh, and I, you know, maybe not luckily for the nation, but luckily for for this particular answer, that did turn out to be the pick.
So it was just kind of rabbit out of a hat?
No, I hope I bring a little expertise to this. His name had circulated in conservative circles for a long time. He was a very accomplished judge. He'd been kind of auditioning for the court. There was a lot of reason to think it would be him. Some people on the evangelical right had another candidate. But by the time the list got down to three or four people, he seemed to be the likely one.
Well, I bring this up because, Michael, I wanted to get a sense of how you, and you mentioned earlier there are some days where you kind of blow up the show. Talk about the process of how that works. When you're in the middle of a story, and we went through something very similar on 1A, trying to figure out how to deal with breaking news or whether to deal with it or whether to kind of give it a day when we can wrap our heads around it. What's the thought process like when you think you might have to blow up a show?
The first stage is denial, and my reputation, I have the deepest sense of denial. I mean, I now have like a 10-minute kind of like, you were just meditating backstage, Michaela. I almost have like a meditative stage where I have to decide that like, you know, we probably have to blow up the show. But my first intake is denial, because it's so much work to make a new version of a show that's that highly produced. And so then, yeah, obviously, the second stage is acceptance, and the third is calling Adam Liptak and saying, are you around? Oh, you're at dinner with your wife. Okay, well, when is dinner going to be over? Okay, do you think that when dinner is over, and I hope it's not your anniversary, it's your anniversary. Well, okay, so, and that all that has happened because we rely on, you know, we beg the forgiveness of a serious interruption from our colleagues, and then we'll have a quick brainstorm, and then in some cases, you know, this has happened on occasion, someone like Adam will be home and will come up with a complicated jerry-rigged system where he can record himself and he can send us an email from his
iPhone.
It's
amazing what the iPhone can do.
Yeah. But I did want to ask you about that, Michael, in terms of getting print reporters to talk about their work. Yeah. How have you worked through, really for any of you, how have you worked through the best ways to make your story, the same basic information, play properly in print or in a podcast or a graphic? Michael, what's that been like?
We very much divorce ourselves from the print journalism process and story. So we're usually talking to someone like Adam at a stage in the day where he hasn't written a story. So what we're doing is we're essentially tapping into this, you know, decades-long authority of a reporter and using their brain in a brainstorming session to come up with an arc of a story that we can tell that may bear no resemblance to the print story the next day. And that's been really liberating. I think one of the things we wanted to unshackle ourselves from the very beginning was this notion that we were going to talk to New York Times journalists about their print stories. Mm-hmm. And you can hear that on the radio, like, so you wrote in, and immediately the listener sort of feels a little alienated from it because, well, I don't have a story in front of me. I just have a guest I'm hearing. And so we tossed out that convention and said, we will tell audio stories with print journalists, but we will almost pretend that there is no newspaper. And so Adam will never refer to a story. He will just refer to characters. And we encourage everyone who comes on the show to think of it as narrative audio storytelling. I mean, we all owe a huge debt to Ira Glass. And we start stories, you know, at the beginning, and they have an arc, and they have a trajectory, and they land somewhere. And that's been a, a challenge only in the sense that it's not a natural way for a print journalist. The print journalism, Adam, you know this better than I do, Michaela, you tell the biggest thing first. Right. You vomit it out. And then everything else is less and less important. And the Daily, we say, don't vomit it out. That's the biggest thing. I say, oh, you just told the whole story. No, we want you to slowly unfurl it through the questioning. So occasionally it's been just a lot of coaching and learning on the job for everybody who comes on the show.
Kind of teaching print reporters not to vomit.
Yeah, okay.
I do take your point. I get what you're trying to say.
Sometimes there have been meetings, editorial meetings the next day after a Daily episode comes out, and the editors will be like, did you hear Adam and how he said that and how he framed that in the way in? We should do that in a print form. So there are moments where that can kind of turn around and drive a new way into a coverage area that is really interesting.
Can I follow on that, Michaela? It's, mm-hmm. From what you just said, it feels like some of the territoriality that I think was inherent to the learning curve of new media when new media was really brand new has worked itself out. Like I've encountered news organizations where if it was a paper, there was the paper. And then a website, and then a podcast, yep. And an interactive team, and then our TV partnership. But it all went to serve the paper. And it feels like the Times is evolving away from that feeling where the paper has primacy no matter what.
Yeah, I absolutely think it's about meeting our readers, viewers, listeners where they are. And I think that's what's really exciting about new platforms like The Daily, and we're going to be rolling out a TV show next year, that people get to meet our journalism with whatever platform is best for them to consume it. And we, you know, say it's easy to habituate The Daily. And, you know, if you're getting ready and you're getting your kids ready for school, or you're making breakfast, or you're putting your makeup on, as I usually am when I'm listening to Michael's episode, it's a really great way
to... Is that where I meet you?
Yeah, it's mascara usually. It's about time. But it's a really great way for people to bring it into their life, and I think at the end of the day, we just want Times journalism to be out there in the world. And
Adam, how's that for you as a reporter? Is that challenging, making that transition?
It's challenging, but it's very gratifying. And I sort of have the experience, you get a lot of feedback when you're on The Daily. The Daily's very popular, so that's fun by itself. But you also have a chance, in a funny way, the informality of The Daily and the way Michael draws you out actually allows you to demonstrate to the audience that you know what you're talking about, that you bring some authority to it. And it's counterintuitively, it's the very informality of it that underscores that. Whereas when you're writing in these Timesian, sweepy, authoritative sentences, you could be kind of making that up, but you can't make it up quite so much.
That's the great secret.
The most honest words ever uttered. I mean, I think one of the things that, and Joshua, I wonder if you'd agree with this, that one of the things that's changed in journalism is that people are interested in a transparent process by which we admit what we don't know as well as what we do know, and we explain what we're still curious about. And I think one of the lessons of 2016, and it profoundly informed The Daily, was that when you project authority, and that authority is occasionally exposed to not be as authoritative as you thought it was, then people can be pretty upset about that. But The Daily really prides itself on Adam saying, I don't know, or here's what I think, or here's how I came to this conclusion, or here's the process by which I went back and read these 10 opinions by this justice, and I've drawn this conclusion, but I leave myself open to the possibility that I might be wrong. That is a process that I think all of us wish had been built into journalism for a long time. Remember you said the paper, the paper. The paper is a set of tablets for decades that have been handed down to you as if straight from Moses's, you know, mouth. Yeah. But the reality is that like it's a bunch of fallible people putting it together, and I think The Daily, your show, the new era of journalism says, let's just be honest about that.
We have another guest we want to bring on in just a minute, but I want to get to at least one of your questions that was sent in on our Facebook page. You talked about that kind of voice of authority. We also got some questions about dealing with bias. Hunter wrote on our Facebook page, I've heard more than once from fellow conservatives who are like myself and who are into podcasts that The Daily often feels like a PR plug for the Democratic Party.
Ooh.
How would Michael respond to that? What are some things that 1A and The Daily do internally to guard against bias or the perception of being biased?
Great question. I'm surprised by that only because we get a number of emails from Democrats saying, why do you work so hard to represent conservative views? So I think that speaks to... That speaks to the moment, Marin. I point you to the first episode we did on The Daily was with Adam, and we interviewed, and it was, to our mind, a manifesto episode. The founder of Hobby Lobby, the store that was involved in the Affordable Care Act Supreme Court case, came on the show is an extremely thoughtful guy, and he came on the show and he said, I don't believe you're going to tell your audience about all the contraception that we do provide, and I wish you would, and I know you won't. And my exchange to him was, you're saying it will be aired, it will be on tomorrow's show, it was, and that to us was essential, that we were going to represent. If anything, I think we went out of our way to seek out the viewpoints it felt we had not sufficiently represented during the campaign. And I want to continue to make that something that's at the heart of the Daily, even if it offends certain listeners who might hiss in this audience. Because I think clearly there was a consensus in the cosmopolitan kind of coastal worlds that many of us may inhabit, mm-hmm. that turned out to be wrong.
I want to bring in one more guest to add to this conversation. I hear you in terms of being mindful of perspectives and being transparent about the way that we talk about what's happening in the country. There are also some folks who are working to try to kind of explain this country to the rest of the world, including our next guest, whose face will be familiar to millions of us here in the US and around the world. She would often sit in for Diane Rehm, which is the legacy to 1A. You may know her previously from her work on BBC World News America and now hosting Beyond 100 Days. Please welcome the BBC's Caddy Kay. We mentioned that 1A and The Daily both launched at about the same time in 2017. The BBC had its own plans as well, went with a program called 100 Days, now Beyond 100 Days. Talk about the work that you've been doing to try to explain America to the UK and the rest of the world.
Yeah.
First of all, is it as formidable a task as the wave of laughter from the audience would suggest?
I mean, I sometimes feel a bit like I'm a kind of feeding an addiction, that everyone around the world is addicted to the Trump story, and I'm the kind of pusher. And that they want to know more, and there's an element of that that is the train wreck element. There's an element of that that is the reality president, TV presidency element. And then there is also, on a sort of more profound level, what happens to American leadership in this moment under President Trump, and what does that mean for our audiences around the world? I mean, it's still true that for the BBC's audiences around the world, what happens at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and up on Capitol Hill has an impact that is not true of any other country. It's not yet true of Beijing. It may be one day, but it's not. People want to know and always have done what is happening in Washington. That's always been the case. But the Trump factor is phenomenal. We launched this program 100 days, and it was meant to be just for 100 days. We tried to pull it after 100 days, and our press office and our complaints office got call-ins from the public saying, are you kidding? You know, our audiences are up 60%. And it's Trump. It's this fascination with him, with the person that he is, with the policies that he has, with the rise of populism that he represents, and what he means for the rest of the world.
Would you say that Brits are more concerned about what they see from the Trump administration or about Brexit?
It depends where you are in the Brexit debate. Actually, everyone is unhappy in the Brexit debate at the moment. There is nobody happy.
Yeah, no one seems to be getting what they wanted.
Side. Brexit and leaving the European Union is a decision that we have made that is irrevocable, perhaps.
Well, to hear
Brexit is meant to mean Brexit.
Right. To hear the European Council officials, you know, to say it that it's done. Like, you asked for this, we signed the papers, and your eviction notice takes effect in March.
Yeah, let's see. But I think, I mean, there's a realization. Ever since Trump was elected, my editors in London have kind of been saying to me, so he leaves when? I mean, you know, give me the departure date, whether it's going to be Mueller or whether it's going to be the fact that he doesn't get a second term in office. And now they're starting to say, oh yeah, actually no, we realize this is defying political norms, and therefore perhaps Trump does stay another 4 years, but Brexit is, in theory, forever. Look, we've talked about bias. I think it's very important that we recognize that there's large parts of the country that feel they've had their country taken back, and large parts of the country that feel they've lost their country. Mm-hmm. That's similar. There is nowhere else I know where the political divide is as intense and personal and emotional anywhere in the world, apart from America, as it is in the UK. I mean, I feel it's exactly that same mood. I'm in both these countries that I am attached to.
That's the BBC's Caddy Kay, one of our guests from our event held here in D.C. at the end of last year called 1A and the Daily. We'll hear more from all of those on stage in just a few moments, including how the BBC and the New York Times and 1A try to keep the president, keep any president, from dictating what makes news on any given day. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Rothy's. Rothy's is the everyday flat for life on the go that comes in four fashionable styles for women: the flat, the point, the loafer, and the sneaker. Fun designs and patterns while still looking polished and professional, with new colors launched every few weeks. Best of all, Rothy's are made from recycled plastic water bottles and completely machine washable, so you can feel good about wearing them. Go to Rothy's.com and enter code 1A to get your flats and free shipping.
Hey, thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Peter Sagal. Come try the only show that treats the news the way it deserves to be treated, roughly, with lots of tasteless comments. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's wrap up some of the highlights from a special event recorded late last year here in Washington. On stage with me at the Lincoln Theater were Caddy Kay from the BBC, Adam Liptak and Michaela Bouchard from the New York Times, and the host of The Daily, Michael Barbaro. High on the list of audience questions were concerns about the apparent obsession by parts of the news media with every tweet and every utterance from President Trump. Michael Barbaro was eager to respond to that.
We have developed an internal barometer of basically when there's too much Trump. And when there's too much Trump, especially on a Friday, we will turn to the weirdest, most wonderful other story, like Tanya Harding. We did a full episode on Tanya.
Weird, yes. Wonderful?
She's really come a long way. And she's at... She's at peace with herself there to a degree. She turned out to be very supportive of Donald Trump, if you listen to the episode. Anyway, so we have this barometer, and we will say that's it. Friday, another time we did the history of Weight Watchers. It was this extraordinary journey of a reporter struggling with her own weight, talking about Weight Watchers. I mean, so we had this sense, and it's kind of intangible, but you all know it. Too much Trump, too much chaos. Too much anger, and that's when we go ice skating, you know.
Adam, how do you think through that, in terms of this idea of too much Trump?
So luckily, my beat is only occasionally Trump-linked, but you know, the travel ban litigation—you have to cover it. The Chief Justice gets in a fight with the President of the United States. You have to cover it.
Yep.
But I'm happy to say that a lot of my beat concerns legal issues that have nothing at all to do with the President of the United States.
One thing that Michaela said about the speed, and I think all of us feel like we get to Friday and we've been in a spin dryer and we can barely remember what happened on Monday, because the pace is more frenetic than anything mm-hmm. I've ever known, and it's true for all of us. But I do think to some extent that is why people are turning to The Daily and to the 1A, because actually people crave that moment of, you know, of extended narrative and calm and mm-hmm. and slowness and thoughtfulness and deliberation, which you cannot get in this frenetic Trump yeah. era otherwise.
And yeah. humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Say again, Michaela.
Well, I just was humanity. I mean, I think that at the core of all of these stories is still a human story, and it's really important that Michael and The Daily bring on the voices behind whatever issue, if it's the fires in California, mm-hmm. that you're talking to somebody who's really experienced it. And also, these platforms allow listeners to get to know the reporters as well. I mean, it's a very intimate medium where all of a sudden you're hearing someone whose byline you might have seen, but you don't know that Maggie Haberman's also a singer, you know, or that Michael Schmidt will like literally do whatever it takes to get the story done. So he'll go into a Kinko's and like accost a clerk to use a landline to call mm-hmm. in. And those are things that I don't think people would necessarily have experienced.
Right. And they bring a little levity to what is not at all kind of a laughing mm-hmm. moment in American civic life, but you do have to laugh. I mean, sometimes, you know, when it comes to the president, I'm trying to put this politely, sometimes all you need to do is just play the tape, right? Like, what's interesting about this moment is, you know, those lessons they teach you in journalism school, that the truth is enough. You don't need to put any spin on it. You don't need to write an overly sweeping lead that contains too many adjectives or adverbs with this presidency. This is an adverbless present. Like, it all kind of speaks for itself. And that's the power of some of these new medium, especially audio, is they're just playing the snippet of tape is, in some cases, all you need to hear.
Could I piggyback off that? Rick tweeted a question regarding tape. He asked, how do you balance dialogue and sound clips? If I have a problem, it's when a clip either reiterates an articulated point or sets up a point to be immediately reiterated. Mm-hmm. You have great guests. Why not just let them talk? How do you balance dialogue and tape?
So I'm not the audio person. I can tell you about a tick I do that I definitely hear people find annoying. So what you're saying is, and I repeat back what they say, and that is...
And I do it. Right. I'm guilty.
And the
I'm
reason
guilty.
We do it...
And then
is,
the reporter says, oh, Michael, that's exactly right.
Yes, brilliant.
Right.
Brilliant. Brilliant host.
And then I feel brilliant.
And then, you know, they can come on again.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly.
Well,
that's how it
the
works.
The reason we do that is because we have to... Well, first of all, it's a tick of the daily, but we also anticipate that... You're doing the dishes, you're in the car, the light just turned red or yellow, and occasionally when we really want you to understand something, we're gonna use an audio tape to punctuate it, or Michael's gonna say, so what you're saying, because we really wanna make sure you don't lose that point in your life, because you're busy, and you've got things going on.
Let's get to some audience questions now. I'm gonna get to some of your questions there. Michael, I think they
gave
you...
Yeah, I have questions for you.
Yeah, Lord help it. We'll get to one question on his sheet last, but no, we'll go back and forth. We'll go back and forth. Let's see. Let me get to a question from Leslie. I wonder, Adam, if you could take this one. Leslie texted, if you could ask one question to one politician who had been given truth serum, who would it be and what would you ask?
Oh, that's hard. That's hard right on the spot like that. I'm going to let Michael handle it.
Oh, I mean...
No.
I'm surprised to hear you say that because, I mean, you covered the Kavanaugh hearings. If you had to ask somebody a question with truth serum, I think I'd ask some of the characters in that drama, did it happen? Did this thing...
Well, the main character you might want to ask that of may not remember because blacked out.
Caddy, how would you answer that? If you could ask one question to one politician who'd been given truth serum, who would it be and what would you ask?
I guess you'd have to ask Donald Trump if he likes being president. you know, what he thought it was going to, you know, to get a sense of what he wants to do next.
Oh, what do you think the answer would be?
Say again?
What do you think the answer would be?
I don't know.
I want you to read one of the questions, Michael, from your sheet. But before I do, I'm kind of surprised at the end. I don't have a problem with them, but I personally wonder if the only biggest answer is to ask Donald Trump, did the Russians help you
win
the election?
Okay. Yeah. Very good.
Like, that's the question.
Collusion. Right.
But I don't balk at the questions you asked either. I feel like this is one of the struggles of doing journalism right now. Like, that's the $64 million question.
Yeah.
If I had truth serum, I would ask President Trump, how much, if at all, did the Russians help you win the 2016 presidential election? But that also goes back to this tension, like, right of all Trump all the time. Like, it's the big story, but there's more to talk about. And so, I mean, there's that tension. And I'm not sure what we do with that.
And it's also possible that they helped him and he didn't really know they were helping him.
Right. Exactly. Michaela, let me get a question for you from Caitlin, who asks, since today's media landscape is so unpredictable, what do you do when you have an important story to tell, but it's more evergreen, and it gets pushed out of the day's rundown because some major news broke?
That's a great question, and it does happen. And I think it's just staying present with that story. It doesn't mean that the story won't have its moment. But I think it's also relevant to say, is there just too much? Is it too much for the audience to consume this daily news story and also make sure that they have the attention span with all the other stuff that they have going on in their lives to also pay attention to this story that we think you need to see? So I think it's okay every now and then to hold something and make sure that it has its moment and you surface it at the right time. And that also lends itself to maybe tightening a few things up, making sure whatever you're presenting has all of the necessary elements in the best way that you can deliver it.
Adam, how much is that still an issue? I mean, you are a beat reporter. You have a very important beat. But I wonder how much that is an issue today with new media. I mean, it's not like you have to hold a story because there aren't enough column inches in the paper. You can still drop it online.
We have endless space, but not every story will surface. So Michaela does a nice job in trying to make sure that every story gets the attention it deserves. But we publish out of the Washington Bureau alone 25 stories a day. And getting that in front of people who no longer, for the most part, flip through the paper page by page, but are consuming and getting to our stories in a spot way through social media and so on, making sure that the stories we really care about get to people is a real challenge.
It's a really interesting kind of reckoning that I think all of journalism has to deal with. How many URLs a day do you all consume? I mean, if you say it's 10 and a place like The Times presents you with 200, it's a really interesting question, you know, throughout the future of this medium. Of, I guess that was always an issue in the past too, but you paid for the paper, it came in front of you, we kind of assumed you were going to leaf through it. With the web, we now know that you don't pay for lots of other stuff and you consume it anyway. And so, you know, that also drives a new form of storytelling. I mean, you really need to find a way to grab people's attention.
Or maybe you really only consume one URL, which is Facebook.com.
Right.
And then everything else kind of flows through that. Let's get to another one of the questions on your sheet, Mike.
Yes. So, Babette, which is a fantastic name. Oops, you know what? I like the name, but I prefer a different question. So,
that's your prerogative. Yeah.
I apologize.
A tribute to the next question to Babette, too.
Yep. Yeah, let's just attribute this to Babette, not Kristen. She asks...
We love you anyway, Babette. No, yeah. Nothing personal, baby. I'm real sorry.
Kristen forever. Do you find that this period in our history is more polarizing than any other time in American history? And then it goes on to say, specifically as it relates to freedom of the press, which I'm curious if we're polarized about the freedom of the press or if we're just polarized, but I would ask.
Do I find this time more polarizing than any other time in American history? No, especially not as it relates to freedom of the press. We have been through this before. It's important that we remember that dissent and polarization is not a bug of American democracy. It is a feature. We're supposed to be able to disagree and not have a king cut our heads off, right? The way that we suss out what we're to do in a democracy is to disagree. There have been political...
The king doesn't cut anyone's heads off anymore.
Well, he...
He's gone. Just quick update.
I beg to differ, I've seen Hamilton, I know what goes on. But you know what I'm saying, I mean, that's the way that democracy is supposed to work. We're supposed to be able to disagree. Even before we were a country, I mean, go back and look at the John Peter Zenger case, from when New York was just a colony, and there was a man who founded a newspaper for the express purpose of chewing out one politician. The New York Weekly Journal, whose name, I swear to God, was William Cosby. That was his name. But they founded the paper for the specific purpose of chewing out one politician. Can you imagine if there was an entire news organization whose whole job?
I cannot.
And yet here we are. Like we're supposed to be able to fight this out. We're supposed to have the capacity to fight and think and work through the facts and then make a decision. And you don't have to like the outcome, but you gotta love this process. I mean, just the ability to hear what your neighbors are really thinking, to hear them face to face, to be able to engage them face to face, and to have a say and to have a voice and to have a vote means something. So whether or not we're polarized, I think, is almost immaterial compared to what we do with our polarization. Do we run from it? Do we lean into it? Do we try to diffuse it because, oh my God, people are just too noisy? Or do we make room for people to be ticked off? I mean, that clip you heard from earlier, Christine was just, commandeering the conversation. That's why I slowed her down. I didn't mind her being angry. You maybe need to be heard pissed. Our democracy is designed for you to yell. Frederick Douglass once said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. And you as an American have the right and the responsibility to demand power over your communities. And our job is to reflect those demands accurately and usefully. So be polarized, but do something with your polarization. Don't just sit and stew in it. Don't douse yourself with the fuel of dissent. Put it in an engine and go somewhere. That's what makes it work.
Now, can I?
Last question.
I'm going to disagree with you.
Before we go, yeah.
Well,
And I know we got to go, but go ahead, Michael.
That was deeply inspiring, and I know that the world.
Get the queen in here.
There's no room for sincerity. That was profoundly inspiring. Full stop.
And?
I have to disagree with you on the question of, are we more polarized than we've ever been? And I think it's very hard to say that we aren't. And I believe that the rise of full-time machines that exist to gin up opposition, and that's on the left and that's on the right, and that can be as true of Fox sometimes as it can be true of MSNBC, but they're different, for sure, means that we inhabit a new universe of divisiveness, and that's a fixture of our system now. The one bright light I see, and Katie, I want to know what you think about this, is I see millennials moving away from all of that. We know it from the data of who listens to The Daily and the emails and the feedback we get. There's a new generation of news consumers who have no interest in cable news, at the risk of a great financial hit someday in my future. I say that is a tremendous blessing, because those models are kind of broken. But that's the hope. Those people, they want nuance, they want storytelling. Those are the people flocking to our shows. And they tell us that they don't want to consume this kind of ideological machinery content.
Let me give Katie the last word before we go.
I share Michael's optimism about millennials. I mean, in all of this difficult time, you have to be optimistic about something. And it's millennials' commitment to causes beyond themselves, whether it is gun violence, whether it is climate change, a whole host of issues that they seem committed to in a way perhaps that my generation of baby, I'm right at the tail end of the baby boomers, didn't seem to have that. I'm not as optimistic about the new tools element of this, and this is because of the social media component. And somebody described it to me like this, that social media is pure oxygen. Mm-hmm. And you can feed people pure oxygen, and it makes everything about their position inflated and operate on kind of hyperspeed and hypertension. And I don't know how we put that genie back in mm-hmm. the bottle, except for listening to The Daily and 1A. Mm-hmm. was that good?
That was good. That was a perfect note on which to end our conversation. Katie Kay, BBC anchor and the host of the program Beyond 100 Days, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak, Michaela Bouchard, New York Times assistant editor, and Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily from The New York Times. Katie, Adam, Michaela, Michael, thank you all for being with us. Thank you very much.
Our stage show was produced by Steph Collette and Amanda Williams, with help on that night from our theme's composer, Will Eastman, and the fantastic team from 1A and WAMU. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.